Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. We're continuing along with the chapter called A Buddha in Every Realm. This is chapter 3 of this book. And at the end of the last reading, I was talking about the refuge in Sangha as an internal quality. And just to add one little extra thing with respect to that, there's a wonderful English word that most people are not familiar with, which is synderesis, which means the love of the good. It's, you know, you find it in obscure religious philosophy books, but that's exactly what it means. It's like that quality of the heart that rejoices in goodness and wholesomeness. And so it would be a wonderful thing if we had a more common word for that, but so there is a word in English for that, but so the Pali the Pali word gunadhamma, which means that the quality of virtue, it has that a bit of a parallel in English with synderesis, synderesis, synderesis is how I believe it's spelled. I'm pretty sure it's spelled that way. So the next section is called Awareness of Every Realm. In the visual depiction of the six realms, in that mirror held by Mahakala, that's on page 31, it's got Lindsay here, but yeah, with the copy, yeah, you can pass that around if need be. So in the depiction of the six realms, in that mirror held by Mahakala, if one looks closely, there is a Buddha to be found in every one of the realms. There is a Buddha present, even in the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, that of the asuras and the hells. This feature of the iconography symbolizes the fact that in each and every mind state, whether it be heavenly, blissful and wholesome, or unwholesome and painful, such as anger or fear or compulsion, the quality of wisdom or awareness is available. The Buddha is able to visit that realm. There is no realm that the Buddha can't visit. For example, if the mind is lost in a train of thought, say, a feeling of righteous indignation about something, at a certain moment, there is the recognition that the mind has got lost and has been carried away. That recognition is symbolically represented by a Buddha being present in that realm. In this instance, it would be the Asura realm, the jealous gods. Well, could be a few places, but that's what came to mind when I put this together. That righteous indignation, you know, how dare he? That sort of. So the mind is focused on some kind of moral quality or some sort of rightness, but is angry and vengeful and indignant. So the presence of the Buddha in that realm characterizes the quality of wisdom arising, awareness being brought to bear to apprehend and fully know that mind state. As an aside, and on the theme of Buddhist cosmology, another interesting little fact, and in the system of Buddhist cosmology, the Buddha can visit every realm, but there are five realms that a bodhisattva is never born in, and those are called the Suddhavasa. Because those are the five realms that non-returners get reborn in, if they're reborn in the Brahma worlds, and so that total enlightenment is guaranteed from those realms. So that once you've been born in the Suddhavasa, it's the equivalent of the Pure Lands. Suddha means pure, so it's the Pali equivalent, or the Pali Tripitaka equivalent of the Pure Lands. Literally, Suddhavasa means that the pure abodes, the pure realms. So beings are always enlightened in those realms. So, and there can be, there's a whole kind of a whole biology of anagamis and how they the lifespans as they occur in those five realms, the pure abodes. You can be enlightened immediately on appearance. You're not born; you just manifest. You don't have a physical birth. You just will pop into being, and some beings are enlightened immediately as they appear. It's called enlightened on appearance. And then there's other ones that live as there for a little while, and then they become arahants. And then others that are many lives in the Suddhavasa as anagamis, and eventually they realize enlightenment. But a bodhisattva, according to the Pali mythology, is never born in the Suddhavasa because they couldn't be born in the human realm, and Buddhas are always born in the human realm, so that a bodhisattva can appear in all the other different realms, and some of them are even more refined than the pure abodes, the formless Brahma worlds. But those five realms, the bodhisattva is never born into, so that Buddha can pay a visit, but is never born as an entity in one of those realms, which I feel is a interesting message. So also as another aside, an aside to that aside, so in Pure Land Buddhism, the aim of a lot of the practice, a very devotional practice, repeating mantras like Namo Amitabha Buddha, repeating the name of Amitabha Buddha, and the intention to be reborn in those pure lands. And they're very attractive, since you're guaranteed to be in a Brahma world for a long, long time and then realize total enlightenment from there. So it's like a really nice retirement program. That is really blissful for gazillions of years, and then you become an arahant and escape from birth and death altogether. So that's got a certain attractive quality to it. You have a long, blissful retirement, and then off the wheel. I'm kind of making fun of it, but kind of that's why one of the reasons why these things are attractive. But in the Pali Buddhist world, in the southern Buddhist realm, the only beings who are anagamis can be born in the Suddhavasa. But in the northern Buddhist world, practicing with devotion and fixing the mind on devotion to Amitabha Buddha or the other Buddhas can bring about the birth in the Pure Lands. So that Pure Land Buddhism is very, very popular in the northern Buddhist world. But as according to my understanding of it, the being doesn't have to have reached the level of a non-returner in order to be born in the pure abodes. That's my understanding of it. But just it's a bit of an aside. But in terms of realms that that exist, I feel it's got some significance to that. So anyway, going back to a Buddha in every realm. So this is part of the development of mindfulness and wisdom, and that quality of awareness. And also it's somewhat related to in the teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness. In particular the third foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of moods, if cittanupassana, moods and mind states. And in that description, it's almost the shortest of all of the four sections of the four foundations of mindfulness. But it talks about the different states of mind, it's a very even expression. So it says, knowing the contracted mind is contracted, or the expanded mind is expanded. Knowing the agitated mind is agitated, the mind free of agitation is free of agitation. Knowing that the mind filled with lust is filled with lust, the mind free of lust is free of lust. The mind filled with anger is being filled with anger, the mind free of anger is being free of anger. So, and there's no kind of comment about wholesome or unwholesome, beneficial or unbeneficial in that particular teaching. It's just there is this state. And at the end of each of those little descriptions, it says, to simply know there is this, to establish mindfulness to the degree of knowing there is this, you know, that is the development of mindfulness in this instance with respect to that state. So I feel it's a parallel to this sort of the Buddha in every realm. It's like the mind can be concentrated or unconcentrated. There can be the recognition of, wow, it's totally scattered today, and my mind is all over the place. But that which knows the mind is all over the place is not all over the place. That there can be like a wave of intense fear, like, and sort of quivering with anxiety. Wow, this is really intense today. You know, this is really a kind of startlingly or impressively strong feeling of fear or aversion. desire, whatever it might be. But this the image of having a Buddha in each realm is representing, on a psychological level, that sense of, wow, this is really agitated. Or I really didn't want that to happen. Or this is the I've just got exactly what I wanted feeling. This is the very loud yes. That's what this is. And the mind that knows that yes is not tied to it. It's not identified with it. And so that this is also a very frequent theme of Lumpur Cha's teachings, knowing moods and not attaching to happiness. I think I was invited to give a talk about this theme to a group based in Thailand over the weekend. The title of the talk was "Happiness is Suffering in Disguise." So I was referring a lot to these teachings of Lumpur Cha, where he would point out how we chase after happiness and we want to get happiness and call it good and real, and then we run away from suffering. But you know, if the mind grasps happiness in an unskillful way, then it's like taking hold of the tail of the snake rather than the head. You know, if you grasp suffering, the snake bites you right away. If you grasp the tail, it's like grasping happiness. You've got a few moments before the head whips around and the snake bites you. But he would often use that as an image of grasping happiness. So instead, what he would recommend is like that quality of knowing that like and dislike are of equal value, and that the mind that's aware of being excited or being afraid or being irritated, you know, being peaceful, being sleepy, that development of that skill of, you know, knowing and feeling the presence of mind states as they come and go, that's a very significant and helpful dimension of the practice. But we consciously take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha to strengthen that quality of awareness, to make knowing more accessible, to invite the Buddha more effectively into every one of the six realms. In taking refuge, awareness and wisdom can be brought more easily to meet and receive those distractions or emotions or compulsions, be they unwholesome, wholesome, painful, pleasant, or neutral. In this light, it's significant that in the classical imagery, in the wheel of becoming, the Bhavachaka, the Buddha in each realm holds an instrument or an object that is particularly relevant for the beings in each realm. He is using the medium that each category of beings can relate to. And again, this isn't always totally consistent, but it is surprisingly common. So you find very, very similar imagery, say, in Korea or Japan or in Tibet, China, in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Myanmar, India, the same imagery is used irrespective of the country that you find this symbol in. So the human realm, then the Buddha is dressed as a monk. He's holding the alms bowl of a monk, and that, as I was saying, that the manusaloka is represented by the quality of sila, and so that's symbolized by the Buddha with an alms bowl. Also that Buddhas live on alms, they live on the offerings of the faithful. In the Deva realm, the Buddha is holding a musical instrument, a veena, like a sitar, a kind of a stringed instrument. So Devas like music and sensory pleasure, and that kind of. So through that realm of delightful sensory objects, then that's the medium of communication in the Deva realm. In the Asura realm, he holds a flaming sword. So that's their language is righteous indignation and jealously expressing their feelings of and how they are being overlooked and how they should have more power and supremacy in the world. In the animal realm, he holds a book, and classically it would be like a palm leaf manuscript. You would not sort of book, because these are a fairly full European invention, and so it was more like the palm leaf manuscripts. Often it's like a long, thin, rectangular object. So the ola leaf palm manuscript is a sort of classical form for representing a book in these pictures. In the hell realm, he holds a flame, like just a burning fire held in his hand. And in the hungry ghost realm, the Peta realm, he has a bottle of nectar, like a sweet nectar that provides, say, relief from the endless hunger that the Pretas have in their particular realm. Now, these different media represent the skillful means through which wisdom needs to operate in order to have an effective impact in each realm upon each psychological state. Are there any questions, thoughts on that? Yes.
There's a saying about the combining the mind states. And that saying of Ajahn Chah that 95% of the practice is knowing that we should let go and not being able to.
75, say 50 to 75%. I think it's a rough amount, yeah. It's a goodly amount, yeah. Knowing that we should let go and not being able to.
So in that, you know, when your mind is not very well trained, in that micro moment of recognition, oh, I'm feeling righteous indignation, and that literally lasts a microsecond, and then you go back to righteous indignation. And even if you don't get lost and somebody points it out to you, then you just, I just say, yes, I'm feeling righteous indignation, and I won't feel righteous indignation. So is it the way out of this, just repeating the cycle of micro moments of recognition and hoping that one day the pain will go?
yes, that. But also another aspect of it that that I found very helpful, and I believe, it's all a long time ago. I last had a conversation with Lumpur Chah in 1979, so. It's a long, long time ago, so it's 43 years back. So I can't swear to exactly how he phrased it, but one of the aspects of that is, even if you're completely caught up in a state and there isn't any perspective, there isn't enough perspective to slow it down, that you're kind of, roaring, or you're consuming. And that he said, even as you are following some aramana, some arom, some mood, and something in the mind is saying, this is really stupid and I'm going to regret this, the hand doesn't stop, and the behavior continues. And so it's not justifying the behavior, but he said, because he really understood passion, kind of anger and lust and fear, aversion. He was the only defilement he did not specialize in was laziness and dullness. So that's why he said a number of times that people say, "Why are you so wise? You understand everything." It's like, incredible. Can you recite the whole Abhidhamma? And he said, No. I just got so many defilements. I had to learn from lust, from fear, from anger, from greed, from righteous indignation, impatience, complaining, criticism, and so the only one he didn't experience much of was dullness. Everything else was so hot, hyper energized, that dullness didn't get a look in. I found really helpful advice. So if the intensity is so strong, you're really just burning. He said, there's still that in the mind that recognizes this is really stupid, and I know I'm going to regret this. But even though that's not strong enough to stop the behavior, or just the mood, like sitting the whole hour in the temple ranting about somebody who doesn't exist, or who existed 25 years ago or whatever. There isn't the capacity to stop it, but just remembering to listen to that other voice that's saying that, this is really foolish, this isn't going to bring anything helpful. Then once the wave has broken and that mood has passed, either, it's just an internal mood of a feeling of fear or anger or desire that sort of has waned and faded away, or if after you have acted on some impulse, you've spoken out, or you've shouted at somebody, or you've eaten too much, or whatever it might be, then when that's cooled down, then that to use the capacity for wise reflection to say, okay, now you got exactly what you wanted. You really told them what you thought of them. How is it? And to, and the tricky part of that is not letting the mind go into self-view and self-criticism. Like, oh, I'm totally stupid. I'm a useless practitioner. You know, I'm just polluting the atmosphere here. You know, just this is a complete waste of time. And I'm just making life more difficult for myself. And so the mind can easily go into that like, a self-critical rant for many people. But rather than letting that happen, just in a simple and straightforward way, it's like, okay, well, that was acted on. How does this feel? And just to acknowledge, okay, that was the cause. You got what you wanted. You acted on that angry or impulse or that selfish impulse. Okay, and now how does it feel? And that I found extraordinarily helpful. And I always, when I talk about this, I always recommend that the less commentary or explanation, the better. So like, oh, you know, I got lost in that because, or, you know, in the future I'm going to, or I'm never going to do that again. So that even though those might be skillful intentions or might have some value, my experience is, maybe it's because I'm a bit of a compulsive explainer and verbalizer, but just to keep it as non-verbal and direct as possible, okay, that having been followed, what's the, how does this feel? And then just to keep it as tangible, like the physical feeling and the just the emotional tone of it, without a lot of explaining or languaging around it, just to feel it. Say, and even just to say, I feel overfed and a lot of regret. Just to keep it extremely simple, and so then that the painfulness of the result is what teaches us. Like if you put on a shoe that's too tight, you don't have to think it's too tight. It's like, ow. And so I often will, when talking about this, just let that ow have its effect. Because pain is what teaches us better than anything else. And so rather than the superego voice saying, I should never do that again, that's really stupid. Yeah, a good good Buddhist would never do this, and I'm going to be a good monk in the future. That doesn't have so much power as just the anesthetized pain, just to really feel that and let that sink in. That I find it has the most helpful effect. So it's not an excuse to say, oh, well, as long as I feel it afterwards, I can just follow this. And the Ajahn said, it's okay to follow your impulses. As long as you recognize the effect afterwards. Okay, right. I'll go with that. So, and this is being recorded, I realize, so please don't misunderstand that. That's not a sanctioning of unskillful behavior, but rather, if it is, because I think for all of us, and this is very helpful that Ajahn Chah had such a kind of wildly active mind and a lot of difficult experiences, that kind of dynamic is familiar to all of us. So those moments, the kind of little microseconds or moments of clarity along the way, yes. But then also after the wave has passed, it's like, well, what was all that about? Okay, well, I told them what I thought about them. Right. It feels like this. And then just let that have its effect. And my experience of it is that with patience and over time, then that genuine reception of the painful feeling, then as the mind starts to go into a comparable state or impact, you know, following a selfish or greedy or sort of destructive impulse, then it's much closer to the surface that the mindfulness that recognizes, I know where this is going. That really hurt last time. And not because of the brain saying, oh, that really hurt last time. I shouldn't do this. There's no should. It's just like, oh, no. Like, I know that's a hot fire. If I touch it, it's gonna burn. So you don't even have to tell yourself, don't touch the fire, because there's that. You know, it's nurturing that intuitive and direct recognition. Yeah, yeah. That it's a non-conceptual, intuitive process, and so slowly but surely, with ridiculous amounts of patience, then really, really insanely ridiculous amounts of patience, slowly, then the forces that drive that sort of destructive or negative and unhelpful behavior, they lose their strength. They're deprived of their fuel. They lose their strength. Okay, so to continue. So the next part of this chapter, even though I was not really intending this to be a sort of meditation, general meditation handbook, I did include because in each of these retreats that I led, about five or six retreats on dependent origination that this book comes from, in each of them I was giving the sort of basic essential instruction in meditation practice as well. So this second part of this chapter is where I talk about establishing a basis of loving kindness, developing the quality of concentration and focusing of attention, and the development of insight, vipassana, and also then the recognition of the role of the unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, the ultimate reality as part of the basis for practice. So that this whole second part of this chapter is more about these basic meditation qualities, so I'll read through these, but that's the purpose, so that within this book there's also that sort of fundamental meditation guidance is included. It appears in many other books as well by myself and other people, but I felt it was useful to have as part of the whole mix these different skillful means. So the first one is called loving kindness, expressive and receptive. Another aspect of the symbolism is that the Buddha is always a loving presence. Even if he's carrying a sword or a flame, Buddha wisdom is the embodiment of profound loving kindness, that radical acceptance which facilitates the process of liberation and frees beings from the wheel of becoming. Many years ago, when Ajahn Sumedho first began teaching in the United Kingdom and in Europe, he would use the classical phrases for teaching loving kindness, metta meditation. May I be happy, may I be well, may all beings be happy, may they be well, and so on. Probably many people, most of us are familiar with these Ahang Sukhito Omi, these classical phrases for developing loving kindness, and then also the classical modes of visualizing different kinds of beings, either going through categories of beings, human beings or animals, and birds and fishes, or visible beings, invisible beings, or spreading loving kindness geographically around the room you're in, or the building you're in, and the place you're in, and then through the countryside, around the area, around the country, around the planet. And so these kinds of ways of teaching loving kindness meditation, Lumpur Sumedho would use those when he first came to teach in the West in 1977. I imagine that most people are familiar with those sort of forms of metta meditation and the kind of going through the lists of beings. Also, another form that is quite standard is starting off with yourself, and then beings that people that you like are very important to you, people that you are indifferent to or you don't know very well, and people that you dislike or they dislike you. That's another way of categorizing the different forms of beings and different ways, formats for loving kindness meditation. So, when he first began teaching with these phrases, may I be happy, may I be well, may all beings be happy, may they all be well, most English people would think, ugh, this is so sentimental. It's really annoying. You're trying to teach loving kindness, but it makes me really irritated. It's too sweet, sentimental, like thinking pink. So Lumpur Sumedho has described this very, very often. Perhaps me saying most English people is a bit of an exaggeration, but a lot gave that kind of a feedback. And it's not just in England, but in the States as well, that actually one of the people who was, I think it was a One of the Insight Meditation Society teachers, they did a day-long meditation at the place in California, Spirit Rock, and the title of the day-long was "I Hate Metta." There's probably, if you look on Dharma Seed, there might be a recording of the "I Hate Metta" day-long. It's about this, you know, how that kind of sentimental or thinking pink, you know, over sugary sort of Disney-esque, not to malign Walt Disney and Walt Disney films, but that kind of oversweet and sentimental would bring a negative result with it. I remember one person on a retreat saying to me, "This was I'm recalling this. I was doing fine. I was very happy until you started teaching metta. Then I got really angry." So yeah, you know, when I first started running teaching retreats, and you thought, well, okay, you should have a day of metta practice or something, and then I would just use that same kind of format. And then in one of the interviews, somebody said that, like, I was doing fine, yeah, you know, I was having a great time until you started talking about loving kindness. So a very negative effect. So Ajahn Sumedho is a very creative and adaptable teacher. He thus employed some skillful means and changed the language that he used to describe metta. He defined it instead as, quote, "not dwelling in aversion," unquote. In a similar vein, the phrase that I like to use for metta is "radical acceptance," quote unquote. It follows on from Ajahn Sumedho's lead. It describes a principle of acceptance, not dwelling in aversion. We can have metta for that which is not likable. And in a way, this is the central principle. It applies directly to dependent origination. If we confuse metta for meaning that we're supposed to like all beings and all mind states, it can easily be irritating, because there are many things about our own minds and other people and the world that are not likable. Those holograms of anger and conflict are still hot and painful, but they are the way they are. The Buddha carries a flame to those realms, but he's not averse or impatient. He is as calm and benevolent as he is everywhere. And this is also, I'll talk a bit more about it, but as I go along. But this is, those of you, there's a chapter in the book by Lumpo Sumedho called "Mindfulness Path to the Deathless," called "Loving Kindness," meditation on loving kindness, and that talks in a lot of detail about this practice. And the point he makes there is that you can have love for something that you don't like, that liking and loving are not the same, that acceptance is not the same as approval, so that you can say, you know, have a painful illness or the weather can be, you know, really really challenging, really cold or really hot or really windy or something, and you can't make yourself like it, you're not trying to like it, but you can accept, well, here it is, there's this illness, or there's this, you know, this challenging weather, it's like this. So that over and over again, he would emphasize that acceptance is not the same as approval, and that was something, using the word love in English, it tends to imply both, that having love for something means that you're implying that you like it. And over again, he would say that accepting something is not the same as trying to make yourself like it. And I found that a very, very helpful principle. So that's the essence of this approach here. If you have chronic pain, or if you've had a headache for 3 days, you can't like it, but you can accept it. Here it is. If you have a difficult family member who is causing you a lot of stress, you can't like that, but you can accept it. This is a practical and realistic way of understanding metta. It's a quality of acceptance and open-heartedness, of clearly seeing this is the way things are, quote-unquote, rather than trying to feel like we have to force ourselves to like everything. If we have an angry mind state, or if we feel a wave of jealousy, fear, or craving, we're not trying to pretend that we like that. Oh, hooray, I'm really angry. My anger is so beautiful. We're not trying to create that kind of attitude, but rather we acknowledge when an angry feeling arises, this is anger. It feels this way. It's part of nature. It's like this. When we establish a foundation of loving kindness, this means establishing a readiness to accept what we like, what we dislike, and what is neutral, with an open heart. We're not being biased. We're not judging. We are recognizing in this moment that the mind's experience is exactly this way. This is what the Buddha being present in each realm is intended to mean in the iconography of the wheel of birth and death. When we understand and learn to use this attitude of radical acceptance, it doesn't mean that we are being passive, which is another very important part of... So when we use a language of this is the way things are, or acceptance, it can imply, all right, just let it happen, and kind of being a doormat, or letting the, in the words of Hamlet, to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, just to kind of go passive and just let things happen. It's not, that acceptance is not what we mean by this word. Doesn't mean that we're being passive. Accepting doesn't mean going numb. Our hearts don't freeze. Acceptance doesn't mean that we refuse to act or respond to an experience. It's simply a recognition, here we are, it's like this. If you're driving to Paris, so a lot of these teachings were given in the south of France. If you're driving to Paris, enjoying chatting to a friend, and then you see a road sign that tells you that you're just entering Nice, which is in the opposite direction. You were in Provence, and so Nice is to the south, Paris is to the north. If you see a road sign that tells you you're just entering Nice, you might wish that you'd not gone 50 kilometers in the wrong direction. But that's where you are. So, rather than criticizing yourself for taking a wrong turn, you accept what's happened. Oh, I'm here. It's not where I expected to be. Now, how do I get back on the right road? You accept where you are, and that acceptance informs how you act in order to head in a better direction. So our capacity to act and make choices is also part of the way things are, which is a piece sometimes people, very, very regularly people miss that. So we talk about accepting the way things are. And I know many people have listened to Lumpur Sumedha for years and years and have assumed that he meant, therefore, just don't, kind of quote unquote, don't do anything, and thought that he meant to be passive or don't engage. But I feel that's a very unfortunate and unhelpful misunderstanding, because our ability to make choices, like I was saying here, once you realize, oh, this is Nice, not Paris, we've gone the wrong direction, doesn't mean, say, okay, well, here we are, let's enjoy Nice instead. Good, beautiful place, yeah, by the Mediterranean, okay. You can do that, but if you need to be back in Paris to go to work, then your capacity to turn the car around and head in the opposite direction, that's also part of the way things are. And our decision, the decision-making process, and the capacity to act on mindfulness and wisdom is also part of the way things are. It's not an intrusion or an upsetting of the way things are. It's not a disturbance of the way things are, but it's part of the way things are. Yeah, essentially, how could it not be? In a way, this quality of metta is the route we follow in making skillful choices. This is directly related to dependent origination, in that it is about learning how to make choices based on wisdom and mindfulness rather than reactivity. If acceptance meant taking no action, then once you've taken that wrong turn and found yourself in Nice by mistake when you had some commitment in Paris, you would then think, oh well, I just have to stay in Nice. This is called stupidity. No offense to the Niçois, if that's the right word. But that was just an example I was using. So, any questions, thoughts on that? Yes.
If metta is accepting things as they are, what's the difference between metta and equanimity?
Good question. I often talk about it as sort of metta is the entry point to equanimity, or loving kindness ripens in equanimity. So metta is the first of the Brahma Viharas, and upekkha is the fourth one. And so that metta is establishing that openness, and the result of that openness or its fulfillment. This is just one way of talking about it. So its fulfillment is in that quality of equanimity. So metta is a lot to do with how the heart relates to other beings, say, and the you know the presence of other beings and the habit of the mind to be judgmental about other beings or mind states. This is good, that's bad, I like, I don't like. Equanimity, upekā, I feel is functioning on a bit more of a refined level, and upekā is about that quality of stillness and peacefulness in the midst of a lot of activity and turbulence, agitation. So this isn't the only way to relate to it or to understand it. The full refinement of loving kindness, I would say, it ripens in upekā. And you can look at it as a kind of a circle, loving kindness relates to a basic attitude towards all beings. Karuna relates to the experiences of unhappiness of other beings. Mudita relates to experiences of happiness of other beings, and then upekā is a sort of skillful relationship to all conditions, so that any kind of agitation or busyness or turbulence, then upekā is that the experience of serenity or stillness in the midst of great activity.
When you wish someone happiness, and you wish them well, and good, then there is a feeling you have a feeling and that loving kindness, and that's metta.
Mm-hmm.
There is acceptance, but it's also a feeling there.
Yeah, so that's what the other part of metta that I will talk about is the expressive part. So it's receptive and expressive. So there's the taking in part, which is the acceptance, and there's the expressive, the sending out part. So I'll get to that in a moment. So hopefully, where have we got? Yeah, we've got 20 minutes. Yeah, we should be okay. So that, that's why I like to talk about it as expressive and receptive. So that there's, like the breath, there's the in-breath and the out-breath. There's the breathing in, the receiving the air, the oxygen keeps us alive. And then the out-breath is the expression. Literally means to press out. So the metta has its expressive quality as well. So I'll talk about that in a minute. If we can establish this basis of radical acceptance, then when we are observing the activities of our mind, whether in terms of feeling, sense experience, liking and disliking, we know these activities for what they are. If something is ordinary, this as the feeling of something being ordinary. If we experience dislike, then we know this is the experience of disliking. The mind is able to appreciate those qualities of experience just as they are. We learn more and more about liking and disliking. We see them clearly, and this is a major means whereby we can free the heart from its addictions. So, relating to dependent origination, so when that vedana paccaya tanha, the feeling, conditions, craving, so the more there can be an acceptance of, say, disliking, then that doesn't cross the bridge into tanha of hating and wanting to get rid of. Or if there's a feeling of liking, there isn't that vedana paccaya tanha, the feeling, conditioning, the craving of, oh, I've got to get more of this, this is really great, how can I get this for me? And so that greater quality of acceptance, just knowing liking as liking and disliking as disliking, then it strengthens that capacity for vedana natta paccaya tanha. If we experience dislike for something and are able to know that feeling clearly, then the mind will not grab hold of that dislike and turn it into hatred or deep aversion. If we're unmindful, then pain becomes a problem. It becomes the enemy, quote unquote. It becomes something that has to be brought to an end by any means possible. When the mind grasps pain, it's born into the feelings of hatred and aversion. But if there's wisdom and mindfulness, the feeling, the sensation, can simply be known as it is. This is unpleasant. I can't make it pleasant. It's just this. It's just a painful feeling. That's all. Dislike doesn't have to lead to hate. In exactly the same way, when we like something, we taste some delicious food or we see some beautiful countryside. So this was in Provence in the springtime, so it was extremely beautiful countryside and very delicious food, I must say. I'm happy to compliment the retreat managers. They did them. It was a dangerously attractive mealtime. It was a very kind of comfortable retreat. They had a lot of deck chairs out in the patio. So after the mealtime, the majority of the retreatants would take the sitting posture in the deck chairs and enjoy the sunshine of Provence in April. Not to make anyone feel jealous, there's a lot of sukha vedana in the setup in this particular place. We experience a feeling of liking. We can experience that liking and know it just as it is, as a feeling of delight, of pleasure. If we are wise, we recognize that we don't have to add anything to that. We can just let that delight, that pleasure, be what it is. It is this way. But if we're unmindful, if we're unwise, then the mind grasps hold of that. We try to get more of it, or keep it, create the same experience in the future. We get so excited in grasping that taste, get so busy in the mind, that we end up missing the taste in the moment. A friend of the monastery once told me that she took her family to a resort on an island in the Mediterranean. We found this beautiful village on a little island. It was the perfect hotel, the perfect beach. The kids were so happy. I spent the whole holiday trying to figure out how I could book the place for the next year. So I didn't enjoy this year at all. Because you couldn't make a booking a year in advance. There was a policy of the little pension that she was staying at. Ruined the holiday trying to get it for next time. It's a painful story, but I often tell it because it's a really good example of how that's what happens. And similarly with food, and I think especially if the food is really delicious, and probably many of us have had the experience of when it's a bowl full or a plate full of exactly what we like, then, oh, this is amazing, this is incredible. Where did it go? What? My bowl is empty already. I better get some more. We're so excited about the first lot, we have to go and get a second lot because we were wrapped up in the kind of compulsion of consuming the first one. I'm not spying on anybody or taking notes about anybody's eating habits. This is just how many of us are as human beings. I've certainly had that experience. Like, oh, where did that? That went very quickly. So that you think, well, I better have another one because I wasn't paying attention the first time. So this time I'll be really mindful. Many years ago, I was on a retreat with Ajahn Sujito. One day after the meal, he had this glow in his face, and I said, "You look very happy, Ajahn. What happened?" And he said, "I ate a potato." He looked that kind of angelic, like sort of St. Francis of Assisi in the marketplace. You know. He said, "I ate a potato." It looked like it had been a profound religious experience. Yes, it was amazing. I ate a potato and I wasn't doing anything else. There was the experience of being hungry and having a taste of potato. Just being present for that experience was extraordinarily delightful. So this area of Dhamma practice, this dimension of meditation, is very rich for exploration. If we can bring our attention to the present moment experience and fully attend to what's here and now, then we can find that quality of satisfaction and fulfillment that most of us are seeking in life. We wish to be content, we wish to be fulfilled, we wish to be at peace and complete, but if the mind is always looking for the next and the next and the next thing, we're tied to the wheel of becoming, we're tied to that cycle of addiction. The heart, even though it longs for rest and completion, never experiences any rest, peace or completion. To put it simply, we can establish this insight: I can like, but I don't have to want. I can dislike, but I don't have to hate. On considering all of this, it can be seen that the practice of loving kindness has both a receptive and an expressive aspect. The expressive quality of metta manifests in the conscious radiating of benevolent feelings towards others and to oneself, while wishing, spreading kindness, sending goodwill out to every being. It's like the out-breath. The receptive aspect of metta is like the in-breath, taking everything in and opening our hearts to each other and to the way things are. This is the radical acceptance, the not dwelling in aversion, the attunement to the reality of the way things are, that is also the life source of wisdom. Accordingly, just as it is the in-breath that gathers the oxygen that our bodies need to stay alive, and it is the out-breath that expels the unneeded carbon dioxide, so too, I would say, it's the receptive acceptance aspect of metta that is its essence, and the expressive aspect, which is a natural and helpful result of that. So I realize that's the only way to relate to it, to understand it, but in working with this, these practices, and looking at these qualities, I feel that's a helpful way of understanding it. And so that, and I think also that sense of just trying to think the words, you know, may I be happy, may I be at peace, may all beings be happy, you can just get lost in the sort of laundry list of beings. That go, oh, did I forget? Oh, I forgot the fishes. All right, yeah. I did Hertfordshire, Essex, Kent, and then Sussex, Greater London. How much is Greater London? Yeah. Is Surrey part of Greater London? Yeah. You can kind of get ridiculously caught up in the kind of the technicalities of it, and forget that the whole thing is intended to be based on that warmth of the heart, or that quality of kindness in the heart. And so I find when teaching loving kindness meditation, if I am teaching that as a particular practice, then I'll tend to emphasize this aspect of acceptance, radical acceptance, and then to the extent possible to help that to be clarified as a quality of kindness and appreciation for all things. And then once that quality of kindness or appreciation, acceptance there's a felt sense of that, a sort of a warmth in the heart or an openness of heart, then to be consciously spreading that out. It's like if you haven't got sort of sweets to hand out, if the sweets are in your possession, you can't hand them out. You've got to have the goodies to hand out in order to be able to pass them out to other people. So rather than just having the words in mind, then establishing that genuine quality, and then once that's established, then to make that effort to spread that out to other beings, and using any of those forms, either in terms of geographical spreading or through categories of different beings, or beings that you like and appreciate, and you have natural warmth towards, or beings that have struggles or conflict with, and so on. Those forms are not bad or wrong. I wouldn't dismiss those at all. But I feel it needs to be informed of that fundamental quality of the strength of genuine kindness. And that's, as I said, like the in-breath is what brings the oxygen into the body, and it's the oxygen that keeps these bodies alive. It's that attitude of radical acceptance as the life source, or the power source of genuine loving kindness. Any thoughts, questions, reflections? Yes.
It seems to be the case sometimes that people, meditators who do a lot of metta are the ones who practice it, or at least inclined to practice. Or sometimes it's the case.
Say that again.
So it seems to be the case sometimes that people that need metta the most are the least inclined to practice metta. it doesn't come as naturally to some people to receive and generate it. Mm-hmm. So then I guess upon practicing it at the beginning, it can feel mechanical. Is there a way to sort of a softer way to enter it
that can be, yeah, that can feel a little less sort of like you're going through the motions. I guess would that be reflecting on, you know, things that people care about first, or for the harder hearted?
it's a good question. It varies a lot from one person to another. I mean, like Sister was asking about equanimity. So you can, in a way, start off with equanimity. If people are like, don't talk to me about kindness, grr, you know, bah humbug, kind of anything that's got that any sort of emotional softness to it, they just, something just shuts down it just, there's a reflexive resistance. So yeah, there's no reason why you shouldn't approach it through equanimity. And in the classical verses of the developing the Brahmaviharas, ahang sukhito homi, may I abide in well-being, may everyone abide in well-being. And so that that's the development of metta. Then may all beings be released from all suffering is karuna, compassion. May all beings not be parted from the good fortune they've attained is mudita. And then the upekha it changes gear. It's a reflection on cause and effect. I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma, whatever karma I shall do for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So equanimity, it's a whole, the first three are sort of a group, really. And then equanimity, the way of developing it is, like I was saying to Sister, it's like a whole kind of extra layer of refinement. But if that's what people can relate to, if they can, don't talk to me about kindness, but causality, yes. Like, you know, they've got a mind that likes physics and mathematics and cause, you know, nice hard-edged, you know, biological principles or mathematical principles. If that's what people can relate to, then you can approach it to see things in terms, and why we use that reflection on cause and effect in terms of developing upekha, it's also very close to insight, to the development of vipassana, because it's changing the view from a person-centered or a self-centered perspective to a nature-centered perspective. This is the cause, this is the effect. I'm the owner of my karma. This action was taken, here's the result. Yeah, I chose to read this book, and so this is the book that we're hearing. You know, that's the cause, this is the effect. You've chosen to come along to the reading, so you're sitting in the sala at the moment. This is the cause, this is the effect. And so brings that quality of evenness of mind, that sense of, oh right, it's just, this is the way nature works. This is the choice that was made, this is the result. I ate too much at the mealtime, so now my mind is really sleepy in the afternoon. That's the cause, this is the effect. It's not personal. Again, you're not making excuses. Oh, therefore, if I just label it not, you know, cause and effect, then I can eat as much as I like. But it's not that. It's like, well, this is a dull, sleepy mind, and it's the result of putting too much food into the stomach in the morning. That's the cause, that's the effect. It's not personal. It doesn't make it wholesome or useful. It's just seen in a non-personal way. And so that helps to bring that an evenness of attitude. And it's like a gateway to wisdom and to liberation. Upekha, it's the last on the list of the 10 paramitas. It's the last on the list of the 7 factors of enlightenment. It's the last on the list of the 4 sublime abiding. So, and the last one on the list is usually the most refined of many of the Buddha's sequences that he does. So it's an emotional quality, upekha. It's got that quality of refinement and attunement to Dhamma, that it is an emotional quality. It's a conditioned state, but it leads very naturally into insight. So if someone can relate more to that reflection on cause and effect and learn and just use that as a way of relating to feelings and thoughts as natural processes, that can be a way that they develop loving kindness, because then it's in relating to their own being, their own mind states, and then the people around them are like, well, she's like that because she's always been like that. You know, that why do I make a problem out of it? Oh, that's how she is. Therefore, so when I meet this person, that's what I find when I meet her, because that's the way she's always been. That's the cause. This is the effect. It's not personal. I might, whether that's something I'm comfortable with or not, it's not, there's nothing wrong with that, nothing bad about it. Lumpu Cha gives this really lovely example about monkeys in one of his Dhamma talks. He said, if you have a monkey, a monkey's nature is to jump around and be busy. If you want the monkey to sit still and be quiet, like, you don't understand monkeys. Monkeys just do what monkeys do. You know? So if you realize, oh, it's just monkeying around because that's how monkeys are, then it's not a problem. It's still a monkey, but you're not feeling that it should be otherwise. So that kind of, oh, well, this is how the way things are, or this is this isn't personal. It's not me or mine. It's just the way nature works. Aha! And so there's that there can be a lot more sort of compassion and forgiveness for other beings. Like, oh, that's just how this person is, or that's how he is. Like, if you are working with Jose in the kitchen, there's likely to be music. There'll be a certain bursting into song will happen from time to time. My ears tell me. That's what happens in the Amaravati kitchen in these days, in the Jose era, is there's occasional something of a cue for a song. What is an expression? And so that's a way that, you know, that people can approach that and find that quality of accommodating each other. And so that sense of compassion and allowing things to be the way they are, and not contending against allowing monkeys to be monkeys, is very much a part of what we talk about, or what we mean by loving kindness. That sense of not dwelling in aversion, as Lumpur Smita put it, or not making the adding on the idea of wrongness, or it shouldn't be this way, but here it is. It's like this. So, people's characters vary, and so if a person doesn't incline towards loving kindness, and any attempt for anyone to try and make them be different is met with even more aversion and resistance, then also another useful thing is to not bring the subject up at all. Just embody that quality yourself. Don't try and explain Buddhism or teach it, but just be it. And then by example, it's like, why is she so bloody peaceful? She's always got that smile on her face. It's like, it's really annoying. How do you do that? So I'm not joking. Sometimes that just the sort of leaving things alone and just letting how you are and the good aspects of how you are have their effect, that can have a more potent form of communication than using words. So another hour has gone by, amazingly, so let's leave it there for today.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.